उद्धरेत् आत्मनात्मनं नात्मनं अवसेदेत् आत्मैव ह्यात्मनो बन्धुर् आत्मैव रिपुर् आत्मना. दिस श्लोक फ्रॉम भगवद् गीता मीन्स एलिवेट योर सेल्फ थ्रू द पावर ऑफ योर माइंड एंड नॉट डिग्रेड योर सेल्फ फॉर द माइंड कैन बी द फ्रेंड एंड ऑल्सो द एनिमी ऑफ द सेल्फ. सो वेलकम टू बी नज बाय माया एंड दिस इज रीतिका अलॉन्ग विद माई को होस्ट अर्जुन मनोहर. Today we have with us George Illerich. George is a behavioral scientist. He is the founder of Match Culture, which is a behavioral strategy firm for government, businesses, individuals, and communities. He is a keynote speaker, a TED speaker. He works as a mental health lead, and he's a social psychologist and a comedian as well. Thank you for being here, George, and thank you for giving us your time.
Yes, thank you, Ritika and Arjun. And thank, like Maya, I love the whole concept. And so thank you for your hospitality. Thank you for the opportunity to be here and talk about what we all love, human behavior.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Joe. Thanks for having you here. So you have had a highly hyphenated career, and an illustrious career like this must have an equally interesting story behind it. So I would just start here with a very simple question. Who is George
Illerich? And you know what? I am what you just said. I am a hyphen. I mean, I am the person between the gaps. And I think what I'm really trying to say is that, you know, because I love that question and I also hate that question, only because once we use language, we constantly rely upon language to define who we are and our limitations and our abilities and capabilities. And so what I like to say is I am who I am in the moment. So right now I'm a behavioral scientist. I'm a social psychologist. You know, I'm a comedian. I'm very passionate about social impact. I'm very passionate about mental health. You know, those are things that in the moment, you know, are very much who I am. To even answer that much more and less succinctly, is to probably talk about the work of Benjamin Hardy, who talks about how personality is something that we should hold very loosely. And that is something that we should not necessarily take seriously. And the one way to do that is obviously distancing yourself from your past versions of yourself. And so, you know, when you ask me who I am, I'm George Illerich, who is George Illerich in 2020. If you ask me who I am 3 years from now, I might be less of those hyphens and something completely different. And so, you know, who I am as a person who's constantly growing and evolving and adapting to my environment.
That's great. You called yourself a behavioral experimentalist. So would you expand on that a little bit? What is behavioral experimentalist?
Yeah. Yes. So behavioral experimentalist is simply just a combination of two things. Of course, it's the combination of using behavioral science and using the residual data that comes from behavioral science, but emphasizing and maybe even at times overemphasizing the importance of the human element. So when I say I'm a behavioral experimentalist, I'm focusing more on the human elements behind the experiments that bring the data. So we always really tend to hyper-focus on the data when we're looking at the behavioral research and the processes and the projects that we're creating. And sometimes I think we over-rely on the data to tell us about human behavior, when really I think if we're going to over-rely on anything, we should over-rely on the humans and their behavior that are bringing the data to us. And so for me, when I call myself a behavioral experimentalist, it's trying to look beyond the conventional approach to behavioral science, which really does tend to hyper-focus on the data. So I'm very much more passionate about the projects and the research work that leads me to understanding human behavior. And sometimes that means spending a lot more time with the humans than the data.
Talking about the conventional approach of so far how behavioral science as a concept works, most people assume a position of, like you said, of data. They collect it, they analyze it, and then they come up with a solution, right? More often than not, these solutions are a bit short-sighted because they only take in one facet of the conversation in mind. Like moving forwards with you, like you said, you're more practical. So where do you see that differentiation coming in? Like, how do you see that differentiation helping you from other behavioral scientists or other behavioral experimentalists who are a little focused on getting the data first, then completing their analysis?
Ooh, great question. So I think one of the major differentiations, especially with nudge culture, is that we are a postmodern behavioral science company that looks at culture and context as the primary indicators of what influences behavior. And there's a tendency to rely on older research projects and data, and then to create either understandings of human biases, and I would say reduced understandings of human biases, and even universalized understandings of human behavior based on one particular research project, which really is unfair. Because, I mean, ultimately what you're doing is you're attempting to understand human behavior, but let's say it's by Thaler, you know, who did a research project that was in the 80s, and you're saying, well, based on his research, all humans are like this. And so I think one of the fundamental differentiations between what we do is we are very hyper-focused around the idea of context and in the moment and looking at human behavior and even the data as indicators of what's going on in the moment with that particular group that you're working with. And so you're trying to understand human behavior from a cultural and contextual background rather than trying to universalize all human behavior through this reduced group that you're working with.
Okay. So follow-up question to that. So by being in the context, and to a great extent, the context is defined by our perception of the reality, right? So my understanding of this current context would be sort of different from someone else's understanding of the current context. But the even if there's an overarching theme, sometimes our perceptions seldom match the reality, which may skew the context. For example, like a joke could go either way. It could be out of context, it could be in context, you could be laughing, one guy could be offended. So if from a stand-up comedian perspective, like how does the behavioral angle play into that?
Oh, I love that. That's fun. So when you're doing stand-up, you are constantly reading a room. You are constantly having to read facial expressions, body movements, tics, laughter. I mean, anything and everything that comprises human reaction is part of your radar. And so for me, I think there's actually a distinct connection between what we do as behavioral scientists and even social psychologists when we're studying social dynamics of human behavior, is that we are looking at human behaviors. We're looking at, you know, the Freudian slips. We're looking at what's being said, what's not being said, what the reactions are, what the lack of reactions are. You know, boredom is actually a reaction, for example. And so, you know, I think all of those are very, very interrelated and interconnected in the way in which we try to understand the demographics that we are attempting to do research projects with or on.
So you mentioned about the present and about being in the moment. So I just realized that if I take a moment now and observe what is in my mind, then it's actually not in the present. It is either thinking of the past or it is thinking of the future. And I think with all of us in across the globe navigating through this pandemic, it plays a very primary important role that we focus on our mental health, because we are not in the present, and our emotions and our experiences on a daily basis, they are evolving, and it may be that we are experiencing a lot more than we usually before the pandemic. So I think emotional agility as a concept holds a lot of importance in the present context we are in. But that said, it is very difficult to be emotionally agile. For example, for me right now, I'm thinking about a lot of things. I'm thinking about my college. I'm thinking about this recording. I'm thinking about the podcast. So that's how it is. So how do you bring emotional agility? And I recently was watching this video because it is difficult to manage all that is happening together. And there was this video by Jon Kabat-Zinn. And he explained that how we do not remain in the present. We are in the hopes that we will be satisfied in the future, but then the future comes and then we are not satisfied, and then we look for another future, then again that is not satisfactory for us. And that's a vicious cycle. It keeps on moving. We are never satisfied. So how do you bring emotional agility is one. And the second thing is something that I have also practiced. I did practice initially, but now I have lost touch, is mindfulness.
Yes.
So it is about being aware, that's my understanding, but it's about being aware of the current moment we are in. And your recent post about mindfulness also mentioned that it is not bulletproof. So what does that imply? And in this environment that we are in, how would we achieve that state of mindfulness and emotional agility?
Oh, wow. Okay, so first we need a magic pill. I think those are great questions. And I wish we had hours upon hours to be able to actually wrestle through all of this, because I don't think we're going to get to this kind of silver bullet that's going to fix everything. One, because of context, because everybody's different. But at the same time, there are tools and strategies that have worked for many people. And I think to maybe start, if I can, kind of even a little bit before that is, you know, why is it so hard to maintain emotional agility? You know, one is, and well, I believe it's two things. One is McDonald's, and two is clumsiness. Now, let me make sense of what I mean by that. So McDonald's is this globalized fast food phenomenon, right? Where there's billions of people served and we spend so much time there and people know what it is. It's a symbol, but even behind the symbol, there's a culture. And there's this culture of expectation and entitlement. There's this culture where we assume that, you know, that convenience is part of our right of just being who we are as a species. And I think for so long, what that does to our awareness and connection to emotional agility is it actually reduces the ability to be emotionally agile. And so why? Because if we're constantly chasing after what's convenient, and McDonald's is just a symbol of convenience in general, and the velocity and the speed of our desires, like I want it and I want it now. And so, you know, McDonald's just represents all of that. And so I think that we need to understand that if we want to embrace a posture of emotional agility, we need to actually slow down rather than speed up. Because agility is like a muscle. You have to take time to actually build it. And that means you have to intentionally make space and make it a priority in your life to be able to chase after, plan out, and strategize those tools that work specifically for you. And I think that's one of the critiques on mindfulness, is that mindfulness, because everybody's neurocognitively different, and so mindfulness is going to look different for other people. So a lot of people tend to stereotype mindfulness as I've got to sit in the lotus position, right? And I've got to have one of these little nice bells over here that I've got to ding every time at the beginning and the end. So we have this very almost esoteric, an esoteric approach to what we understand mindfulness to be, rather than this engaging practice of spending time being fully aware of the moment. And you know, you mentioned Jon Kabat-Zinn, who I love, and you know, one of his arguments, which is not really his, it's pretty much, especially from the mindfulness community, is this idea that there is no past, there is no future. It's just the present moment. And I think, you know, the problem with me saying that, by the way, is that it has become normalized. People have overheard what I've just said way too many times. And the reality is that you need to find another way in. So you need to find a way in that doesn't just rely on stereotypes or doesn't rely on what has become conventional when we're approaching things like mindfulness. And what that's going to look like is different for you than it's going to look like for me, you know, or Farjun or anybody else listening. And so we have to understand that we have to take a little bit of our own personal responsibility when we're trying to be people who are embracing a posture of emotional agility, because emotional agility is not a quick fix. It's not a red or blue pill that you just take and reality either goes away or the reality that you want appears. It's this something that you have to take time and you have to create behaviors and incentives and strategies that actually help you succeed, you know. And you were talking about the environment, right? Yeah, let's be honest. The time that we're in globally just feels like crap to many people. And people are using words like, I feel like I'm in prison. I feel like I can't do anything. I feel, you know, I hate quarantine. And so the phrases that we use are very, very powerful and they're very interesting. You know, and there's a lot of neuroscience behind this. For example, you activate the reticular activating system, which is kind of like your brain's heat-seeking ability to go out and seek what you're claiming about yourself. They actually did MRIs on monks, and these monks were using mantras, and the mantras were, you know, I am peaceful. I am anxious. And so what was interesting is that each MRI showed that when they would make these claims, it would actually light up the very areas of our brain that we identify with who we are. So it wasn't just that we were making some linguistic claim, that we were just using language and that we could just, oh, sticks and stones, you know, maybe break my bones, but words may never hurt me. It's actually the opposite. Words actually hurt you. And so if you're using the language of, I am depressed, I am sad, I can't do anything, I feel powerless, well, you are literally, and in one sense, minus all of the pseudoscience, creating your own reality, you are walking into an environment where you have already impeded any possibility of growth or success.
So you have mentioned that there is no past and that we have to live in the present, and that emotional agility is a long-term thing. We have to practice mindfulness again and again, and then finally we will be able to achieve it. So that is true. It's like just when we are getting acquainted with a new subject, we have to go through it again and again to get the hang of it and be good at it. Similarly, it is for our mind. We do have to practice it again and again. But with the human nature and with the thing that words have such a profound impact on our minds, so does our past. And when we have experiences in our past which are a little troublesome or are traumatic in nature, we carry that forward in our lives. And that is one of those factors which prevents us from moving forward in our life. And as you mentioned, that we do create our own reality. So somehow we are relating those experiences and we're not letting go of them. They are still there very much in our mind, and somehow we are planning a reality in coherence with what we experienced earlier. So how do you think our past experiences and that traumatic experiences have an influence on our minds and on our stability of our minds?
Oh, I think that's such an important question. And, you know, I think when we come to understand what trauma is, and I think that's where I would like to start, if that's okay, is trauma isn't just something that someone experiences when they're a soldier, you know, often some sort of foreign battlefield. You know, trauma can also be, and this is a very generic definition, but trauma can also be the repetition of the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves, you know, and so trauma can be those habits, those beliefs, those things that we have either accepted true of ourselves and the environment around us, or have been forced upon us by others. And so, yes, you can have those typical traumatic stories of, you know, kids who were physically abused, or, you know, kids who were sexually abused, you know, or whatever it is, kids, you know, who have been turned into child soldiers, you know, and those are obviously traumatic as well. What I find interesting about the idea or the notion behind trauma is that we've stratified it. So we have created a hierarchy, like the child soldier is somehow, you know, has more trauma than the person who might accept that they have no worth because they've accepted the messages given to them by their parents, maybe because their parents neglected them. And so a lot of people even hearing this might think that I'm trying to make the comparison between a child soldier in Africa versus the person who might have an entitled upbringing, who is still dealing with the ramifications of having neglectful parents. And in one sense, I am. And I'm not trying to be controversial just for the sake of controversy. What I am trying to do is tease out how we've normalized what we all understand trauma to be. Because I think we need to first understand what trauma is to then begin looking for tools and strategies and nudges that will actually help us walk away from the narratives that we've normalized as who we think we are because of our trauma. And so, you know, when we're talking about the past and how it affects us, like, for example, in my TEDx talk, when I talk about effective forecasting, well, that's purely relying on the past, which, as you've so articulately, you know, expressed earlier, like, emotions are part of that. And so we begin to over-identify with them to the point where we limit ourselves. We believe in those limitations and we create a narrative that defines them, but not just defines them, but also defends them. So we will sit and walk through our lives and saying, well, listen, I fear rejection. And then the first time somebody rejects us, then we point at that. And so we defend it. We defend our limitations by allowing what's happening in our environment to dictate what those limitations look like based on the behaviors of others. And so, you know, I think the first and foremost, first step that we need to realize about trauma, whether it be the child soldier, or whether it be the person who has neglectful parents, is that both of those rely on us accepting the story that's given to us as true and making it true by walking out our lives in habit, right? And so, you know, and I hope that's what you were looking for, but, you know, I'd also love to get your guys' feedback on this as well.
So, as you mentioned that, yes, the thing with the trauma, I think with me and the experiences I have had, a problem that I have faced is that, first of all, words do have an impact, and I think that I have this ironclad ammo and I would not be affected by what people say, but that's not true. It does affect me, and it took me a while to understand that the anger that I had, it was a consequence of me taking words too hard and then thinking that, am I like this? Am I being rejected? Am I not good enough? But it took me a while to finally get to that. I thought that I am good and I don't care. That is wrong, first. The second thing is, I am very reluctant to let my thoughts outside. So I don't talk as much about what I experience within. And what that leads to is bottling up of emotions in my head. And maybe the problem was trivial, but now, since it's been a year or so, I am thinking about it again and again and aggravating the problem now. and somehow it is shaping my behavior. Somehow everything, every little thing that happens with me, and it is minutely related to that specific incident, I would be like, oh, this is happening with me again. No, it is not. Actually, it is not. If I'm aware about it, if I am in the state of mindfulness, I would know that it is not. But since my mind is constantly going behind and trying to find relations and correlating stuff, I tend to think that it is the same thing that is repeating. I am still no good. These people are still having a negative attitude towards me. And all that bottling up of emotions is very toxic. So for me, it took quite some time to finally understand that the things that I was doing, and there was a phase in my life when I was extremely angry, and I think I would call myself, I was toxic towards me because I was no good for myself. And it took me a while to finally understand what was the exact cause of that thing. And I'm not sure if I fully do understand what was it and what was it not. But I do know that sometimes it is needed that you have a friend or somebody whom you can talk to, talk about your trauma to, talk about your feelings to. And it does have an effect. It does calm you down. But talking for me is hard, and I cannot even start doing that. I think that is one of those things that people find it difficult to do. And if only they had the courage to let go of their emotions, it would have been better. But then there's a fear of being judged. Then there again leads to the fear of being rejected. So it's like this cycle, and people continue to move into it. So how do we talk? That's one of the questions that is a resounding question in my head. And when I think of you, you are very comfortable by being vulnerable. In fact, if I may say, you have used your vulnerability as a source of inspiration for yourself. And you tend to help people because of what you have gone through in your past. And we were reading about your work with the frontliners at Mount Sinai, and you even gave them meditation classes and wellness services. So what goes in your mind because of the experiences you have had in your past? How are you comfortable in being vulnerable? What is that mindset when you are okay in letting your emotions out and telling people your story?
Wow, that's a great question. And thank you for sharing, by the way. I mean, you know, vulnerability, I think, is so underrated in, I would say across cultures. You know, the ability to be empathetic, the ability to be compassionate, the ability to connect is what makes us who we are as a species. We all want that. I mean, there's so much research out there across neuroscience, across social psychology, across behavioral science that people want to connect, you know, but at the end of the day, everybody connects differently. And, you know, and to get to that place of vulnerability, I think, you know, especially if you're a person who is like, hey, I'd prefer not to do that on a stage, right? Then, you know, a really, really quick nudge is to get pen and paper. And I know people have heard this before, but to set that out every night, every day, whatever it is that works for your schedule, and to journal. I mean, Baylor University has done a study on how journaling actually reduces anxiety and worry, and also even helps you sleep better, you know. And because if we're bottling up all of those emotions, whether it be trauma or a fear that we're trying to avoid, then we're literally actually closing out cognitive resources. And so what they found is that it actually opens up those cognitive resources and actually allows even more creativity to run free. So it's actually very, very powerful to actually journal on a regular basis. And so if you're a person who isn't very comfortable doing it on stage or in a public forum, then maybe journaling might also be a very advantageous tool or strategy. But to your question, I think for me, it's taken years and years of pushing myself outside of my own comfort zone. So if we're going to be a little bit more vulnerable here, I used to always fear rejection. But for me, and this is my own technique, is I use one of the many techniques within psychology, which is exposure therapy, but that's not going to work for everybody. So for example, if I'm afraid of skydiving, I'm going to go skydiving, right? You know, if I'm scared of public speaking, I'm going to go and publicly speak. Now, again, the problem is that even when you do research on the efficiency of exposure therapy, the reason why you're not going to find that it's 100% successful is because I don't believe that exposure therapy works for every single person. And so I do believe that it has to be individualized and it has to be down to that person and also their willingness, because the reality is that, let's say you want to become someone who is a professional public speaker and you go and you have your first experience and it's pretty decent, it's okay. And then you have the second one and you completely fail, flop and bomb and everybody makes fun of you. You're never going to go back again, right? Because maybe that's not who you are. And so I think that there is something to be said that even though personality is not permanent, that who we are, there are core elements to who we are. And I think rather than running from them, working through them and then seeing them as ways in which to guide us towards what works for us, I think is incredibly valuable.
Just following up to that, maybe people aren't ready to take that plunge. You know, maybe people aren't ready to put that work just then. They know what they have to do, but they're just not ready to do it. It could be a kind of a status quo bias that is stopping them from, you know, plunging into the realm of uncertainty. But it's just that they hold themselves back because they fear, like, oh, what if something happens? And they build these what if scenarios. And I believe, like, at the, like you said in your TEDx talk, at the root of all these what if scenarios is a past experience, is a past trauma that is sort of preventing you from taking this next decision because of the fear of failure, because of the fear of being too exposed. So I think the question here is that we have, like, inadvertently encouraged a culture of silence, and we've made it normal never to talk about our traumas or feelings. And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think this has something to do with this toxic masculinity where men are supposed to be unfazed by trauma. You know, you're supposed to be barred from ever talking about how you feel. And if you talk about how you feel, you're considered overly sensitive. And on the other end of the spectrum, if you have women who's unfazed by anything that you say, they are automatically rendered cold and insensitive. So at both these extremes, you know, people automatically assume something about someone else, even if they don't completely understand where they're coming from. So how do we change this culture? How do we encourage people to, it's okay to come forward? And I know we have focus groups and everything coming up, but even then, you know, the odds of some people opening up are very little. And a lot of our traumatic experiences go with us to the grave. And a lot of people don't understand. Look at what happened to Chester Bennington.
Yes.
From Linkin Park. He was fine one day, and then the next day he just wasn't there. I can take so many examples, and you go back, Kurt Cobain, another one of them. It's just so many examples of people just taking their life. How can we change this? What is the way forward? And can behavioral science help in any
way? Wow, that's great. So I definitely want to respond to this, and I'd love for you guys to respond as well. I mean, I think, you know, it's funny that you bring up Chester Bennington. So I think he is a great symbol for also something that you were bringing up as well. And that is this idea of implicit bias, right? Which refers to the attitudes and stereotypes that affect our understanding, actions, and decisions, right? In this kind of unconscious way. And what's very interesting is right after he died, for about a week or two, his wife would tweet pictures or quotes or audio clips or video clips of Chester himself and say, listen, this is what depression looks like. This is what sadness looks like. And the majority of the content that she was sharing was him looking happy. And so she was trying to fight against these stereotypes which we get from our bias, you know, our implicit bias or these stereotypes of, well, depression means you're always sad. You're ultimately Eeyore in the story of, Pooh and his friends, and that's what we ultimately think is someone who just suffers from this chronic depression, who's never happy. You know, they're permanently the opposite of the clown, right? And so I think that first and foremost, we need to step out of those stereotypes. We need to realize that there's a reality that are beyond them. But the only way that we can do this, and you had mentioned focus groups, which of course is great, but I think especially the way in which we all have influence on those that we have impact on is us. We start with ourselves. We start with nudging ourselves towards dealing with this trauma. And for some, like Ritika was bringing up, was like, for some, that might literally mean starting the process of nudging yourself towards being more open about your own trauma, which might start with journaling every day. So again, you might not even start with, I need to go publicly shout into a microphone until I feel validated, which again, you're not, right? You're not going to find validation there. And Chester Bennington proved that. He was shouting into a microphone and never found it. You know what I mean? And so I think what we have to realize is that we have to normalize a culture that embraces trauma as being okay. Not that the acts of trauma that we experience are okay, but the fact that we have gone through trauma is okay. And so I think that we need to have more people who are willing to actually step up and do that. And this has to go beyond celebrities just doing it, yep. Right? Because again, in one sense, they have a platform mm-hmm. and people are going to be, well, they tend to be more compassionate, mm-hmm. right? And so that does help. And I'm not against that. But what I mean is that when we're trying to, you know, turn the Titanic around in terms of using a metaphor of where we are when it comes to the social stigma about sharing our trauma, I think we have to realize it's a huge deal. It's going to take a lot of work and it starts with us. And I think part of that is realizing that actually, yes, behavioral science can help you in that you can create your own behavioral framework. You can create personal nudges that will drive you closer towards getting to a point where you feel okay to be more vulnerable. You know, for some, again, like I said, journaling. Maybe for another person, it might be opening up a YouTube and you simply just make every single YouTube video that you make private until you feel okay to make them public. So again, you're still talking, you're still doing the symbolic act of making a YouTube, but no one else can access it until you are ready for them to do so. And so it's using all of these tools and strategies that we have access to, like technology, like apps on our phone, and say, well, how can I leverage this as a way in which to develop vulnerability? And so I do think that behavioral science can help us by encouraging us to create these micro steps to get us to the larger endpoint, which is to be more vulnerable. But what do you all think?
I think like, but with specific to use of technology, I think it's a double-edged sword, to be honest. A lot of people on Instagram and all these different platforms, they seek some sort of gratification from others, not understanding that your trauma is yours alone and it's not about others. And it's about speaking about it is your liberation, is your emancipation. And then when you actually go off and start to do it, the response to a great extent is a bunch of trolls who either make you feel like you just done a big mistake and the other one who are yes. accepting, warm and receiving. But with that split responses, you know, people can take it in many different ways. And I feel like unless we have a handle on how exactly technology is able to help us, it may actually deter from the overall goal, what we are trying to achieve. Yes, you know, celebrities and people at power, people at status, they have that platform and they use that platform and that's great. But it's about the common man and the common woman who go through this every single day, not having that same platform, not being able to reach out to anyone. And if digital and technology becomes a platform, then I'm all ears for it. But right now, I just I just don't see it because I feel it's adding to the problem than being the solution, although we know it is the solution moving forward. So the question is that how can we change that? What would be the necessary changes that we have to make? You know, would these social companies or these social media platforms be responsible? And to a great extent, they have been taking actions. They have been pulling down posts. They have been more quick to react when someone reports on an issue. But on the flip side, you know, a mildly differentiated opinion can be reported and taken down. So,
yes. Yeah. And I mean, I think you bring up a very good point in that I don't think you can look to social media as a way in which to heal necessarily mm-hmm. from your trauma, but mm-hmm. maybe as a way in which to get you to a space where you feel more comfortable being mm-hmm. vulnerable. And that's why I think I specifically said YouTube and making it private, because mm-hmm. I think like you, and I'm sure we've all experienced it, even if it's a random bot, you know, mm-hmm. or a random person just saying something harsh, mm-hmm. you know, that exists and that is out there. And so I think it does have to come down to the comfort level of the person if it's exactly. relative to them. And you also don't want mm-hmm. it to become a virtual, like a virtue signaling thing. Like, look at me, mm-hmm. you know, I'm being vulnerable, because at the end of the day, that's pseudo vulnerability. You know, mm-hmm. Brené Brown says something so interesting, you know, which I think is so important. She says, you know, of all the things that trauma takes away from us, the worst is our willingness or even our ability to be vulnerable, exactly. you know, and the danger in maybe even relying on sharing your trauma on a platform, like let's say Instagram, is that it might re-traumatize you, you know? And so there is that reality of possibly going through this kind of PTSD mm-hmm. and reliving your own trauma again and again and again. And so I'm very, very aware of that being that kind of two-edged sword aspect that people need to be very aware of. But if that they're willing to do that and also control who you share it with, which again is another technique that Brené Brown encourages in, you know, is to control the sphere of people who have access to your vulnerability. You don't just go out and say, I'm vulnerable. Otherwise, it's not really vulnerable, mm-hmm. right? Vulnerable is where you are not verbalizing saying, I'm vulnerable. It's where you have this emotional connection that lives beyond words.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree 100%. And I feel like for us, the platform is that, right? It's the platform that we can reach the most amount of people. And I think that's why people gravitate to these platforms when they feel like they're open to share. The time is now. And they turn to these platforms because that's the biggest stage that they have. Because sometimes they feel like maybe their immediate family or their friends may not understand them, right?
Yes. Yes, that's a great point.
I think it's heading in a positive direction. I feel like people are more receptive these days, and usually because of the, you know, the shift in times and in the change mentalities of the everything from the social political standpoint. You know, we've gone through a very bad phase right now, and just coming out of it feels interesting and feels new, although fundamentally very little things have changed. But I guess the platform makes a very difference.
So I was when I was listening to people talk, and you were talking about social media. So I think that the social media definitely it is a way of letting your emotions out and speaking about what you really feel and connecting with people. Because like you mentioned that sometimes your family and friends, when you think they will understand you, they might not. But one thing that I have realized, and it might be personal, I'm not sure, but it is that everything that happens within ourselves, and if we have to deal with something, it has to start somewhere from within us. For example, George initially mentioned journaling. That was one thing that I started doing. I read it somewhere. I think I was in college at that time. And I was 20 around that time. So I started writing what I was feeling, and I would not read it back. I would just stare at it
and I would throw it. But that did help me. That time I was not that active on social media. I was reluctant to talk to people. So I was not actually maintaining a journal. What I was, if I had a very, very difficult day for me, I would just write it down on a piece of paper and I would just throw it after that. I won't even read it again. But somewhere in my mind, it felt that I have taken a load out of my mind now that the 10 kgs on my head appeared like 5 for some reason. The other thing that I think that this light nudges that we can have for ourselves, because I strongly feel that the journey for you to achieve that state of mindfulness, of being aware, of being happy, it is from within, and you have to take a step to do it by yourself, because people may or may not help you, and one should not really rely on that. But what one should rely on is oneself. That was the I go back to the shloka that I mentioned in the start, and that's that the mind is very powerful. Only that if we utilize that power in the right direction. So a couple of nudges that I have followed, I think, was one of that writing. The second was I purposefully was around people that I knew were accepting of me. And I would be around my family. I would be around friends that I can talk to. I would not really go out there and just say that, hey, I'm having a problem or talk to me. No. But just by being around people, it was a positive distraction for me. And I was engaging myself into things which were more productive for me than talking about my past to myself again and again. So that was the second thing I did. And the third thing, the third small nudge, and I think that was one of the most powerful things I did for me personally, was that when I woke up in the morning, usually the first thing that I do is check my phone. But at that phase, when I was trying to deal with my experiences, I planned a day of I planned 5-10 minutes of doing nothing. I would just wake up and I would sit on the bed and I would just assess what my thoughts are, and I would see how my day would plan out. I would visualize that, and all of that would be positive. It would not translate as much to reality, but somewhere that positive affirmation and telling myself that it's okay, and understanding the thoughts in my head in whatever capacity I could, that was really helpful for me. So all of that was me nudging myself to help me out of that experiences that I should not be with. And to a great extent, I think I have moved past it. There's still a long way for me to go, but those three things really did help me. So the question here is that, do you think there is a way we can rely on ourselves and just ourselves alone to take us out of the experiences, the troublesome experiences that we had in the past?
Oh, wow. Okay, so that's great. I mean, in short, no. I don't think that, and let me explain that, because I think the idea of self-reliance is important in the sense that we take responsibility of, this is the trauma that I have experienced. We need to take that responsibility in that this was either something that I experienced that was done to me. This was a message that was given to me. This was an action of someone else done to me. Whatever that is, we need to name what it is to fully understand its impact on our lives. And it is not to create some sort of trauma-based feedback loop of just repeating it over and over for the sake of just repeating it, but simply understanding our place in that story. But also, and the reason why I say story, I don't mean that to imply that the trauma was somehow fake, but that trauma has a narrative. Trauma does have an identity that comes with it. And we have to challenge that. And part of that, and I think the first step, is to realize that that is our responsibility, to fully understand what that trauma has done to us and how it has limited us. But sometimes to even get to that point, people need someone else outside of them to give them perspective. Because the problem is that what can happen, and this is very interesting, if you actually look up the neuroscience of trauma and the neurochemicals that are released every time we go through that traumatic event, whatever it is, big or small, it's as if we're reliving the story again. And so there are the same regions that light up in your brain that lit up when you went through the initial traumatic event anyways. And so it is as if we're reliving the story again and again and again. And the problem is, and this is very interesting to me, is when I was looking up incentives, one of the things that emerged in my research was that we receive dopamine not only when we complete something or not only when we are rewarded, but dopamine also surges through our brain even when we do something wrong. That's why when you have a child, for example, who gets in trouble, is willing to repeat the behavior again and again, right? No matter what he's losing, because he's still getting attention. But part of the neurochemical apparatus that's occurring is that he's rewarding himself. He's getting a reward. And that's why we still call or say that, hey, negative feedback is still feedback, right? And so when we're dealing with trauma or trying to understand it, we are actually rewarding ourselves, even if we just simply live in that narrative. And the reason why I'm even bringing that up is to prove that if we get into that cycle, which some people have, then we need someone outside of us to help us, to remind us of what empathy looks like, to remind us of what compassion looks like, but also to validate it and say, listen, what you went through was an awful experience, but there is another way outside of it. This is why having things like support groups are extremely important, because then you not only have somebody validating your experience, but then you also have people who, in one sense, are the kind of incarnation of the behavioral science nudge of like, hey, I can nudge myself out of this because look at how they lived their lives, and I can learn from them through things like mirror neurons, right? I can mirror them and mirror their behaviors, and I can begin finding a new narrative and a new identity and a better way of living rather than just this endless traumatic feedback loop.
I think that's right. One of the things that I really like in whatever you mentioned was that it does start from taking responsibility. And it is about understanding that what happened, and acknowledging its premise, not running away from it. And once we get into a loop of something and something that is negative, it is very, very difficult to get out of it. So to stop that loop from happening and to stop that negative vicious cycle, think inspiration and that validation, there are so many places it can come from. And I think that is one of the places where social media comes into picture. Because sometimes, like when we are dealing with something and we look at something, suddenly it starts to look like that specific person is talking to us. And that sometimes it is an enlightening experience, like, okay. And though there are a lot of moments, that a lot of experiences that we do have, but it's like in that moment, you're like, oh, this person talked to me. And I think I feel slightly better. So the perspectives and the validation, it can come from various places, and somewhere that is where I think social media has come to help.
I think social media is definitely one. You feel really good when someone is going through what you're going through, and then you have a friend to sort of speak with. And me personally, when I was going through a tough phase, I just couldn't find the words to express myself, even to the closest of my mates, to my sister, to my family. I just felt like this was my fight and my fight alone. And I wasn't much of a writer, so journaling was clearly out of the window. But my resolve was music. It was my resolute. It's what I turned to. And I found happiness in lyrics. I found meaning in what people were saying. And a lot of these artists became more than just artists. They became more than just songs. You know, they became like sort of anthems or these vivid displays and portals in a window into someone else's suffering. And as suddenly I felt like, okay, you know what? If I think I had it worse, I just now know that someone had it much worse, or someone struggling with a lot of worse things than me. And I slowly became to appreciate that, you know, some problems that I have aren't really problems to begin with. And it starts by accepting. It starts by finding out what is it that bothering you, and how do you fix it. And yeah, so I completely agree to what you guys said. One song in particular that, you know, like snapped me out of it was the song by this rapper called Logic.
Oh, yes.
And it was called 1-800-273-8255, which is the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number.
Oh, wow.
This song, like, it changed my life, right? It was a song about everyone's struggle. It's a song about, if you're scared to talk about yourself, your state, your fear, it was about pain, it was about anxiety, it was about depression, mental health. And it didn't discriminate if you're black, white, or any color in between, whether you're what race or religion. It was the problems that you were going through, and it was not yourself. And many people have gone through it and come out through it with the other side intact. So you're not alone. All you need to do is just pick up the phone and give it a call, you know? And I'm sure someone will be there to help you out. I guess what I'm trying to say is that if we need to move past our trauma, we need to actually speak about it.
Yes. Yeah. And by the way, I love that you brought up music. And it seems like there's a theme here as well, like especially with social media. So what's really, really interesting is it really connects with like research that they've done while many people have been in isolation. And you may have even seen this, where there'll be either like music groups or individuals who are either like famous ones who are holding either concerts on their Instagram feed or whatever it might be. Or you might even see this one, it almost looks like a church choir setup, where it's like the singers are in their little kind of Zoom blocks, and then one will have their screen turned on while they're singing, the other one off. And what's really interesting is that they've done research, and they're actually saying that even spending time doing that releases oxytocin, that we actually feel more connected to those around us. And so it's so funny that you bring up music as well as social media, because I think if someone is feeling isolated, if someone is feeling so isolated that they are in that traumatic feedback loop where they're trying to deal with their trauma and they don't know what to do, even something as simple as listening to music and singing can actually help knock them out of that cycle, at least initially.
Completely.
So since you're talking about our experiences, there is this interesting fact that I was reading about, and it says that more women are affected by depression than men. And I'm going through your Instagram, George, and I see that you have mentioned about this book, Women Who Run With the Wolves. So this book talks about, I've not read that book, but Dr. Estes, if I'm pronouncing that right.
Yes.
As per Goodreads, it says that it unfolds rich intercultural myths, fairy tales, and stories, many from her own family, in order to help women reconnect with the fierce, healthy, visionary attributes of this instinctual nature. So there are two things over here that I want to ask. One is that what is this book about, and why did you like it as much as you did? So that's one. And the second is that Dr. Estes mentions that she got a new way of describing women, and she says that they are fertile and life-giving, and rightfully so. But still, the research says that women are more depressed than men. So why do you think that would happen? So those are the two questions.
Oh my Gosh, I love this. All right, so you're grilling me here. All right, but listen, I absolutely love this. So I think they're very, very important. Could I also share with you a little bit about what inspires me about embracing a feminist posture or stance? So my foster mom was a very outspoken feminist. And I was adopted at the age of 5. And so for her, feminism was always something that was part of the way she raised all of us kids. And so it was always a part of who I was. And so it was, to me, a natural response when I was in relationship or friendship, you know, with women, with the opposite sex. And so, you know, for me, equality is something that I'm very passionate about when it comes to gender. And it's because of her. So that is kind of the origin of what has inspired me and drives me to even, for example, take my kids to the Women's March here in LA when they have it, because I want my kids to be instilled with that as well. Now, because of that, I'm always out looking for books that are trying to understand women from different angles. And so I ran across this book, ironically, from you, Arjun. We're talking about Chester Bennington. So one of my favorite bands is Paramore. So, the lead singer is Hayley Williams. So I was listening to one of her interviews, and she had actually referenced this book because for so long, she had embraced the male archetype as the lead singer because she felt like she needed to, which I found so interesting. So if you follow Paramore way back, you can actually see her dressing up, even though she had very colorful outfits and stuff, she was dressing way more masculine. And so in her new album, she ran across this book, this particular book, Women Who Run With Wolves. And it inspired her to realize, like, listen, there's nothing wrong with being feminine. Like, there is nothing wrong with being feminine at all. And you should embrace it. Now, of course, Estes, she's a Jungian psychoanalyst as well. And so Carl Jung was all about archetypes and understanding those throughout history, as was the mythologist Joseph Campbell. And so that's what drew me to this book. But my intention for this book wasn't just for me to read it. And we're actually going through this right now as a family, was to actually, because I have a young boy and a young girl. And so I want them both at a very young age to be influenced and to be exposed to literature that looks at being feminine as a positive thing. And that leads me to your second question about the statistics. And, you know, sadly, that statistic is still true, unfortunately. But I do think it has to do a lot with our culture and history of mistreating women, of marginalizing women, which isn't just a new novel concept. It isn't 200 years old. It's thousands of years old. You know, this idea of marginalizing women and mistreating them and trying to control them and abusing them, raping them, killing them, you know, it has been normalized over thousands of years, you know, and you can trace this back through archaeology, you can trace this back through religion. It has been something that has been okay, which is obviously not okay. So when you are sharing statistics about women dealing with depression, which, by the way, I think is way beyond the gender pay gap, which, of course, I do think has an impact now in our time and culture. But I think we have to understand that all of this oppression and marginalization towards women has had such a long history. And to me, those statistics make sense. I'm not advocating for those statistics. I'm saying that, of course, those statistics make sense because we've had thousands of years of women being mistreated and marginalized. And that's not acceptable, you know?
Yeah, and speaking of which, and you briefly touched about abuse and marginalization, I think, do you believe, and this is sort of, you know, touching on your second TED Talk, which is how society has failed children.
Yeah.
A lot of these traumas that we have right now are deep-rooted, and they go way back to our childhood. And that history of like us being silent whenever, and just because we were the fact that we are a kid. The most common statement I always heard is, what do you know? You're just a kid. So
yes,
you think that has a role to play in this, because I mean this, the numbers are just baffling. It mentioned 7.8 million child abuse reported in 2018. Only 3.3 of those million received any kind of prevention or post-responsive services. It's disproportionately affecting girl childs than boy childs. It's just a sad state of affairs.
Yeah, it's awful. And again, like you just brought up, I mean, I do think some of the influence is how we've seen children. I really think that we're, as a species, confused by the presence of children in our lives. So I find it so interesting that even, for example, you have these even famous like religious sages throughout the centuries who are saying, we need to prop up children, and people aren't getting it, right? People are just not getting the importance of that. And we tend to marginalize them, and we tend to make that okay because they're not us. They're not an adult. They're not past 19 years old, right? They have the word teen in them. So somehow they are devalued just because we don't have some sort of rite of passage that says, hey, you're now a man, you're now a woman, which I find so interesting, especially in American culture, where a lot of our celebrations or rituals don't even start until they're about 15. So almost on the back end of being a teenager, do we have these rituals or these practices that celebrate the life of the child? Sure, you have birthdays. You know, hey, you're 13, now you're a teenager. But that's more symbolic. You know, the biggest thing that we really celebrate here in America is, hey, you're turning 16, now you can drive. Unless you have a parent who's like so anxious and like, I'm never gonna let you drive ever. You know what I mean? So it is one of those things I find so interesting. And then you look to ancient cultures where some of them would even celebrate, you know, a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, you know, and we just don't have that. And so I think that's very indicative of a culture who says children are not worth it, you know, which is extremely sad.
Yeah. I believe to a great extent, the irony is lost on the parents, because when we were small, we were put in education systems where we all have the same uniform and it's conformity, and everything has to be exactly as the other people because everyone is equal and yada, yada, yada. And then you come at a certain point in your life and it's all of a sudden like someone flipped a switch. Now it's about individuality. What are you doing with your life? Why aren't you different? Why aren't you doing something else? Look at what this kid is doing. I mean, he's going to MIT. What are you doing? Like, when did that that statement change? Like, you know what, you have to wear black shoes, it has to be polished, to right now, you know, you need to go out, you need to move out of the house, you know, you're 18, you need to find yourself a job. For the greatest time of our life, you're still figuring out, like, okay, can I say this? Is this okay? Is this fine? Am I going to be in trouble if I say this? And all of a sudden, it's like, why aren't you speaking up?
Oh, man, I'm telling you, you've hit it. Like, I mean, because so I've been invited like 2 days ago to go speak to a TEDx high school club and virtually, obviously. And one of the first lines that I'm working on right now is very connected to what you're saying. And so what I'm critiquing is like, we need to stop asking kids, what do you want to be when you grow up? Because really, what are you doing? One, you are framing their desire. You are framing, you know, yes, their limitations. You're framing their dreams. And you're framing their creativity by this need to somehow create these students who become obedient citizens for the workforce. And so it's like, no, think beyond this. Mm-hmm. We need people who think beyond simply just what are you going to do to make money? Because really what that then becomes mm-hmm. is, hey, life is all about money. And then what have you done inadvertently, even if you didn't intend to, by simply asking that question, you've created a culture of anxiety around the development of that individual person. So meaning, like, if they grow up and they're not making enough money, then I'm never enough, right? So if you're constantly framing that question by what do you want to be when you grow up, you are already handing them mental health issues. You were already handing them limitations. You were already handing them a script for life. And to me, that's extremely dangerous. No.
I agree. I completely agree. And if you like go back to this conversation we're having, there are two significant themes that's coming up in terms of behavioral sciences. One is how we should sort of adopt self-nudging.
Yes.
As a technique to improve our self-control, and also as a standpoint of behavioral experimentalists and behavioral scientists, how can we cultivate a culture of citizen choice architects where each person creates their own choice architecture and nudges themselves into a better future? Would I be right in saying that?
Yes, completely. And I think we have to start a step prior to that. And so you and I have talked about this, Arjun, as well, is where we are nudging the desire first, not just nudging the behavior. Because ultimately, what we're also talking about is using behavioral science to motivate people to want to nudge themselves. And I think, again, because we have a culture of powerlessness, we have a culture of too many choices, right? I just go through the deer in headlights, right? Because I just can't make a decision. I'm too locked up, right? And so what we have to do is we have to nudge people at the level of desire. We have to motivate them. We have to make them see that, listen, this is something that's going to benefit me for the rest of my life. But again, if they're in this feedback loop of trauma, they're not going to see that, right? They're not going to want to see that, because some people over-identify so much with their trauma that if they let it go, they're literally going to be lost. And the reason why I bring that up in connection with this is because I do think that trauma can be anything that keeps us from our potential, whether that potential be corporate, like in a business setting, or whether that be individual in the context of what we're talking about now in relationship to self-nudging. And so I think self-nudging has to start with how do we motivate people to get them to where they are, where they want to be, sorry. And so I think part of that structure is creating behavioral frameworks and nudges, whether it be them or allowing them space to discover what they need to become who they want to be. And so it's even something as simple as using things like, you know, something as corny as printing out an image of Ryan Reynolds or whatever it is and saying, hey, this is who I want to be. I want to be a famous comedic actor who has six-pack abs, whatever it is, right? And so it's giving, something as simple as using a printed image of another guy to get us to the point of like, I need to get my crap together to be able to be what I want to be. And so again, to me, that's not nudging the behavior. That's nudging what comes before the behavior, which is the motivation to lead you to the behavior. Because that picture is obviously not going to give you the six-pack ab. Because you could sit there looking at a nice picture of Ryan Reynolds and still eating a 12-pack of donuts, right? That's not going to get you anywhere except diabetes, right? And so at the end of the day, you have to start there. You have to start with self-nudging your own desire, or at least having a clear picture of what you want, and then making space and making it a priority in your life to say, I want to do this, and I'm going to do this, and this is how I'm going to create a framework that not only allows me to, let's say, for example, get the six pack, right, but also rewards me for getting to that point. And so you have to create these micro steps that include incentives for each micro goal that's actually achieved that will get you to whatever it is that you want to achieve. If you want a doctorate or if you want a six pack, whatever it is, right? Stop watching The Simpsons because Homer's not a great avatar for who you want to become, right? I mean, I'm kidding, but at the same time, it does matter what's in your environment because it does actually have a massive influence on you achieving your goals, you know?
So, and just to build on what you said, so what we're saying is the process of self-nudging starts by understanding your desires and then by making micro steps for you to eventually achieve that. Am I saying, did I get that?
Yes, right? Yes. And so, yeah.
I mean, that's oversimplification.
No, yeah, yes. You're right.
I guess, how does one actually begin the process of self-nudging themselves?
Yeah, okay. So step one, awareness. What do you want? What do you want to do? Step two,
okay,
create the environment to get you to your goal. So, and I've been joking about this all along, but you know, if you are in an environment where you are trying to lose weight, but the environment is everything that's in the exact opposite, then you need to remove the stimulus in your environment that's keeping you from achieving that goal, right? If you are a person right. who wants to do better at work, and some of those stimuli that are in your environment are distractions, whether it be, okay, hey, there is, you know, all of these distractions, like maybe there's some guys that are, you know, not really concerned about getting a raise or whatever it is, but you are, well, then you probably need to spend less time with them, for example. And so mainly because your environment influences you. It influences your behavior, but not just that, it actually influences your desire. And that's why I always start with desire. You have to know what you want because it will influence it. If you simply just say, I want to be the best employee ever and I don't want to be distracted, but here is a group of guys that are my best friends and I don't want to give them up. Well, one of two things is going to happen. You're not going to be the best employee that you want to be, or you're going to have to give up some time with those friends, or you're going to have to spend time with them outside of work and not at work where you're trying to focus. And some of them may not like that. And so you may have to ultimately lose your friends. And so what are you willing to do to actually get yourself to that point? So first step, what do you want? Step two, what is in your environment that you need to change or alter? Step three, take proactive steps to get you to the next goal. So another easy example is the person who wants to start jogging as a personal healthy habit. You know, step three would be, okay, I need to now create a reminder in my environment so that I don't have an excuse to walk away from what it is I want to achieve. And so for the person who wants to start running, maybe they literally create a ritual where they will set out their running shoes every night. They'll set out their running clothes every night, right? And then after they've actually done the run in the morning, they give themselves an incentive, whether it be something as simple as a chocolate bar or a Starbucks or whatever it is. So there's somebody that I follow, Mel Robbins. And so one thing that she does after every single fitness routine, she will go to the mirror and give herself a high five. Now, for some people, that's corny. For her, she doesn't want to reward herself with chocolate. But ironically, if you actually do this, and those of you that are listening that think this is a corny act, there's neuroscience behind giving yourself a high five in the mirror. It's very much akin or like the person who grabs and does the power pose for 2 minutes. It actually changes your body posture. It actually changes your confidence and it alters the neurochemistry in your brain. And it makes your brain believe that you have actually got a reward that you deserve. And so what you then do is you create new neurocircuitry, and over time that behavior becomes normal and becomes the new acceptable way of being that you now identify as, rather than just saying, oh, I did this as a New Year bet, right? And then it stops like in the middle of February, right? No, hey, I'm a runner now. And I do think that there's a linguistic component to this, in that you don't just say, oh, I'm running and I hate running. And right, you do have to start making yourself believe over time, I enjoy this. I really like this. But then also say, I am a runner. Because as we said in the beginning of this podcast, they've done MRIs on people who've used I am phrases and found that it actually latches on to the personality part of your brain. And so after a while, when you run and you get up and run and you create the pattern of running and you start saying, I am a runner, you're now the whole package. Now your brain is literally believing this is who you are. Is that what you're looking for?
I think that about sums it up. I think, thank you for arming us with that. With that key crucial information, I think everyone right now can take proactive steps to self-nudge themselves. So with that, you know, I couldn't think of a more beautiful way to, you know, close this wonderful episode. But before we close, we have a few more questions.
Okay, please.
And it's like a rapid fire round.
Oh, awesome. I love them.
Minus the rapidness or the fire.
It's just something.
So it's just questions. Here's the first one. It's a pretty simple one. If you are writing a book, and I know you have, but if you're writing a book, what would the title of that book be?
Ooh. So I actually happen to be writing a book right now, and it's called Apes in a Void. And that's literally about us. The apes in a void are us, right? And so the void is us hanging in space.
Okay.
And it's obviously just a deep dive into the evolution of human behavior, but also the claim that humans don't have behavior. We're not, there's no such thing as human nature. So it's an exploration and an explanation of how we got to the point where we think that to be human is to have a series of naturalized behaviors. That wasn't so rapid, sorry.
Interesting. No, that's okay. I mean, I'll be looking forward to that. What would you like to be remembered for?
Ooh, that's good. So legacy. I want people to remember me as a human being who wanted to make them better and wanted them to embrace freedom and joy as a posture. Yeah.
Very well said. Next question. If you could go back in time, what advice would you give to your younger self?
I both loathe and love this question, only because I'm not one of those people who is nostalgic, meaning like I don't sit there and wonder what if about certain parts of my life. And so I would say just be who you are, you know, hold on to the core of who you are and don't let anybody change that.
Yeah. And if that question was directed towards me, I would say I would probably not change a thing because it wouldn't make a difference.
Yeah.
I think every experience that you had growing up, you know, sort of molds into who we are at this present, at this given point of time. And we ought to be grateful for that.
100%.
So the advice to my younger self, will be just be yourself, like you said. Perfect answer. Final question. What drove you towards stand-up comedy?
I absolutely love to make people laugh because I am a big joy junkie. Like, I love joy. I think joy can help people feel the release that some of them do not have the permission or feel like they don't have the permission to have. And so I want people to actually feel the permission to laugh at the insanity of existence, you know? And so that's literally what drives me to do stand up, is I want people just to laugh at the silliness of being alive.
And I agree. I recently saw this TED talk by Andrew Traven, and he said that in today's overworked, underappreciated, stress-filled, sleep-deprived corporate culture, humor is almost a necessity, right? It's an expression, it's a joy, it's a way to understand each other, you know, sarcastically or not. I think humor has a big role to play in the day and age that we live right now. And that's why, like, I actually get my news from Stephen Colbert, Seth Meyers, and Jimmy Fallon. Right?
Those are good places to go.
Yeah, it somewhat makes the process of, like, impending doom feel less of an impending doom and more of a satirical.
Yeah, thing. And I mean, I really do think there's truth in that, right? I mean, I think life is satire. I think... Mm-hmm. You know, life in and of itself is supposed to be something that we do laugh at, you know, because otherwise we just take ourselves too seriously. Mm-hmm. And then we die without a smile on our face.
Yep.
You know,
that's right.
This has been great. Thank you.
Yes. No, thank you to both of you, you know, Ritika and Arjun, like, thank you so much. And think like Maya, because again, and I can't emphasize this enough. I think to have these kinds of conversations with people, to get beyond the labels and the titles, and to just have fun and to explore human behavior, I think is extremely important and valuable, way beyond even than just who and what is in our field, you know, to encourage people to think, you know, much more actively, and for them to be aware that they can have potential, you know. And I love that that's what you are all about, both of you. So thank you for inviting me and allowing me to share this moment with you both.
Thank you, George.
Thank you, George.
You've really been kind, and I really, really enjoyed this conversation. I would like to conclude on this one thing. I listened in a TED talk, and it did stick with me. And it is, I am here, I am now, I am real. Come and embrace me. It is one of the most powerful things I've heard, and I will carry this forward with me. So thank you once again for giving us your time. It was a delight to have this conversation. One last thing, can you tell our audience where can they find you and how can they reach out to you?
Yes. So I'm just finishing up on nudgeculture.com. So that will be where people can go probably in the next week or so. And then other than that, my main social platform of choice, especially for Nudge Culture, is LinkedIn. So feel free to find me there. Just Google my name, or also just LinkedIn my name. I guess that's probably the proper way to say it. So yeah, that's where I could probably be reached.
All right. So thank you once again, and thank you everyone for listening. To conclude, I would end with the wise words of Peter A. Levine. Trauma is a fact of life. It does not, however, have to be a life sentence. With that, this is Veena Maya signing off. Until next time, be human and courageous.